The following content is provided by MIT OpenCourseWare under a Creative Commons license. Additional information about our license and MIT OpenCourseWare in general is available at ocw.mit.edu.
Then we, at the end, we had this long discussion in response to questions, and I've written up a summary of them. This one I just wrote, and I didn't put it on the web yet with the slides from last time, so I'll try to remember to do that. So let's finish the last questions and then we'll talk a little bit about the first half of the term and what you can expect on that midterm on Monday. With this question, I'm interested in your knowing what the major benefits of group foraging by birds are, other than optimizing their feeding in absence of predators. I'm interested in the anti-predator benefits and the costs that they face. These are the benefits that I could see all discussed in the text. We mentioned before the selfish herd effect, the dilution effect. If you're just one of a group and the group is attacked by one predator, the chances that any one animal will be caught are small. And that is used by animals in their reproduction when they reproduce simultaneously. Like all the animals will have eggs hatching, all the birds will have eggs hatching at about the same time. So if predators come, the chances that any one of them will be caught are reduced. We mentioned increased vigilance because you have a large group, the chances that one animal will detect a predator are greater. You also remember the cooperative behavior of the meerkats, which it's a different kind of benefit from just having a large flock of birds, any one of which could detect a predator, any one of which could detect food. In the case of the meerkats, they specialize. So they seem to have it built in to their fixed action patterns that one of them, well, serve as the sentinel for all the others. And if that one, for some reason, falls out of the tree, like we saw in the video, another one will immediately take over. And the other is the confusion it causes a predator, that when there's too many prey animals running in every direction, he often loses at least a split second when he can't make up his mind which to pursue. Now, I'm sure that that's something that among predators changes with their experience. Predators gain a lot by their experience. They learn a lot, so they're more likely to just wait for the lagging animal or the injured animal. Okay, mobbing behavior. Now, this is something, it's a different kind of group behavior involved in avoiding predation. You read about it when you read about the jackdaws of Conrad Lawrence. You saw it in the meerkat film. It always occurs when the animals detect a predator, but they've not been caught by the predator, where all of them will start exposing, they'll expose themselves to the predator and call, make a lot of noise, but they're telling the predator they're already detected, it's too late to try to catch them. But it does entail costs because they do approach the predator. Sometimes they actually attack. Humans have been mobbed by birds. You know that. How many of you have been buzz bombed by a crow? I have also, because I used to go off looking for small birds and things, and if they'd fallen from the nest, I learned that if you go after the baby, sometimes you get attacked by the parent that's watching over the baby, or babies that are just learning to fly, for example, or if they fall out of the nest. But that's part of the... It's a little bit different. It's the same as in mobbing behavior, although in that case it could be maternal or parental behavior as well. The major cost is that they approach close enough that the predator that's experienced and loses his confusion can grab one of them. And that does happen. Okay. So now we talked a little bit about secondary defense strategies last time, reducing the probability of success of an attack. What other strategies do you know about now that can be used other than running away or mobbing and the things we've just been talking about? The main ones that the text talks about are in a section called Misdirecting the Attack. And he talks mainly about species that are specialized to by their ability to expose a body part that they want to get grabbed. Like the lizard will be twitching his tail. And if the lizard is frozen and only the tail is moving, the predator usually can't resist attacking that wiggling tail. And of course, the lizard, as soon as the tail is grabbed, loses the tail and runs away. So he's got his heart and all his vital organs and all his major limbs. He's only missing his tail, which he can grow back. And there are other animals, too, that have tentacles, for example, that they can lose. And in some cases, those parts that they can lose are very bitter tasting or even toxic to the predator. So there's an additional benefit, and that is they can teach the predators that they're not good prey to attack. Any other strategies you can think of? I mean, what do animals do? They always struggle, right? Yeah. Alarm calls, of course, that's next. We'll talk about alarm calls. Animals always struggle, and remember, a predator like a cat will often be, he will take a while before he will execute the killing bite because he wants to do it exactly right. So he kills the animal. So if the animal's constantly struggling, the chances that the cat will attack him in a way that with a single bite will kill him are reduced. So it pays for the animal to struggle. Because something may happen to distract the predator, make him go away. Maybe the animal will struggle enough that he'll fall into a crevice and the predator won't be able to get him. So his chances are always improved if he's struggling. So that's part of the secondary defense strategies. Okay, alarm calls. You just mentioned alarm calls. It seems, on the face of it, to be an altruistic behavior because the animal that issues the alarm call is betraying its location to a predator. Now, the alarm call might be difficult to localize, but in many cases it is possible to localize the animal emitting the call. And it certainly helps others in the group, alerts them to the predator. But there are many selfish motives too, because once the alarm call is listed, is called, the all the animals will escape pretty much at the same time, a mass escape. So even the animal that admitted the alarm call will benefit from the dilution effect and confusion effects that we've talked about before. And this guy Creswell collected the data on the red shanks. Those are the wading birds that feed on large worms in the shallow waters of beaches. He recorded the attacks by predators on the red shanks, and he found that the birds that were targeted for attack were usually not the callers at all. They were the ones that flew up late, the ones that responded most slowly. When you're a prey animal and you're feeding, you can't be too much like an MIT student. You can't concentrate totally on what you're doing and ignore everything else. You always have to have a divided mind. You have to be alert to predators. It always interested me that in keeping hamsters, that at the time of day when I knew the animals would be out foraging if they were in the natural environment, and I've had them in simulated natural environments, and I control the light-dark cycle. It's actually the most difficult to get them to feed, to eat, because they're so alert to predators. So normally, animals that behaviorists, scientists that study animal behavior, will study them when they're calmest, which is not the time when they're most active, not the time when they're foraging. It's actually for rodents, it's the time they're in their tunnels, and they're more relaxed because they're hidden from predators. Also, I wanted to point out one other effect that I think was mentioned as an aside someplace in the text there, that sometimes the alarm calls will have another benefit for the prey animals, and it'll attract predators of the animal that's attacking them. Because, of course, many predators are also prey animals for larger predators. You remember the hunter that pays attention to the alarm calls of the birds, so he knows where the tiger is. Well, those alarm calls are alerting the more lethal predator, human with a gun, to the presence of that tiger. Well, that happens in nature, too, when humans aren't evolved. Okay, now this question, I'm not sure what I was thinking when I wrote this question, because in looking for the answer to it, I couldn't find that there are two distinct alarm calls, although there could be. So I admit I'm not certain whether they have more than one alarm call, but they have two main predators, and those two predators elicit very different responses. For all I know, they only have one alarm call, and then each bird has to recognize whether it's a peregrine falcon or a sparrowhawk. But the sparrowhawk tends to come in low, and the best thing for the animal to do is to fly up to escape the sparrowhawk, whereas the peregrine falcon flies up high and basically dive bombs and catches animals in the air, usually. So the best thing is to crouch down and remain completely still so they don't produce any movement that will be immediately noticed by the falcon. So yeah, it would benefit them if they had two different alarm calls, but I don't know if they actually do. But they do respond differently to those two predators. They can detect them. And of course, they would be in different parts of the retina and so forth. I'm not sure how much that aspect has been studied by redshanks. I've studied that to some degree in hamsters. They have different... If I use the very same little black ball as the stimulus, they will respond to it like it's a potential predator, and they will respond differently if it's in the upper field or if it's in the lower field, particularly the lower peripheral field. They respond as if it's a ground predator when it's low, and they're more likely to run for the nearest hiding place. And it doesn't have to be their tunnel. If it's their tunnel, they'll immediately run into it. If there's no tunnel available, they'll run in any place they can squeeze into. Yes, their fixed action patterns. The animals will do it. You know, they don't have time to learn it in their short lives. Certainly hamsters, you know, they don't live that long. They live a couple seasons. And they wouldn't make it to the second season if they had to learn all these things. So these are built-in responses. Of course, when I'm studying them in the laboratory, these are animals that have never seen a predator except humans. And yet I can get all these things. I've elicited amazing fixed action patterns I found quite unbelievable when I first saw them, because there were things that the hamsters had never had anything approaching it. I've had animals that have only been fed, you know, on these pellets that they give rats and rodents. Now, these are laboratory animals, so they've not had the variety of food that people feed their pets. And then I could give them sunflower seeds or some other seed, usually sunflower seeds, and the first time in their lives when they get them, they'll show this coordinated seed shelling behavior. You know, they will pouch them and everything. They'll show all the fixed action patterns that I knew from animals that I'd had before, and I would get it the very first time. And there's many things like that in animals, as Conrad Lawrence has described in his studies. I mean, some people thought it was mainly the birds, because early ethologists focused on birds and insects and so forth, but in fact mammals show many, many fixed action patterns as well, and that includes humans. Okay, this last one on stotting behavior has been an intriguing behavior for scientists because it didn't seem to make much sense. These Thompson's gazelles that when they detect a predator, frequently engage in this peculiar running behavior where they'll run a little bit and then they'll pop way up into the air. So they're very visible to the predator. Why would they do that? They're not creating confusion. Maybe people have argued maybe they're causing some startle reaction to the predator, but that hasn't really been borne out. It seems that they do it when they're at a fairly safe distance from the predator. They've detected the predator early enough so they can run away. And they're very fast. Of course, the big cats that hunt them are very fast too, but only for very short distances. And these animals are equally fast, and they can keep it up longer. So they generally will get away. And the Tim Caro summarized, I think he dealt with 11 different hypotheses. I didn't write them out here, but the idea that it does decrease the attacks by the predator was the one that was supported. The predator either learns or already knows, because of the distance of the animal, that he doesn't stand much chance of getting it. So the number of attacks will decrease, and the successful attacks go to just about, I think, zero. He will sometimes attack, but he won't catch the animals once he's doing this. So basically it deters the attack. The other thing it might do, of course, he doesn't discuss this, but by popping up like that, these animals have wonderful panoramic vision, and every time they come up like that above the vegetation, they would get a better view of where the predator is. And they would also find out whether that predator has a partner. He doesn't mention that, but it seems to me that if they paid attention to it, they might find that it does have other functions other than just communicating to the predator that, hey, I'm going to get away. Too bad for you. Okay. Yes?
I also saw something a while back about how when they're actually getting chased, they run in like zigzag patterns.
Yeah, animals. Different animals will do that. Some of you probably, I don't know if you, I should try to find the, I don't know if I have the video of the film that's been on PBS called Great Escapes, but that's one of the things they show, these different species, that when they're running, you know, will suddenly change course. It uses up energy in the predator and it takes more time to catch them. And even though they're not necessarily faster than the predator, the little animals that do that, they can sometimes still get away. Again, you can think of various possible reasons why that might happen. But actually seeing it on the video and see how it works is interesting and fun to watch. Well, I'll look for that video, but we won't have time to see it, of course, before the exam. All right. So what have we done? We've read Scott 7 chapters, only chapter 8 on reproductive behavior remains. And for that, you can rely on the study questions I wrote for focusing your attention on the things that I thought were more significant. There certainly were other things in there. In general, I won't be able to ask you more than about one question per session, per class session. So it's a pretty limited sample that we can take of your knowledge. But presumably, because you know we're going to do that, you'll study everything. But you can focus on the study questions for the Scott readings. And what were the other readings? We read Conrad Lawrence. Sorry? Yeah, we read Lawrence, King Solomon's Ring. We read Tinbergen, two different chapters, on kittiwakes, the cliff-dwelling gulls, and on the sand wasps, the digger wasp, the female digger wasp, he studies. We read another thing by Lawrence, his Foundations of Ethology. We read the central, not all, but most of the central section of that book called, the central section was called Genetically Programmed Behavior. And there, you just focus on the key concepts. If you look at the headings of the chapters, you will see, I'll go over them in a minute, those headings, you'll see. Because again, I can only ask you just key things. Some professors will ask you little details to make sure you're paying attention, that you came to class and this. I am more interested in you knowing the major things, the key things. I'm not going to ask you little details. Okay? And if you want to use an example and you can't think of the name of the species, I'll never expect you to know a scientific name. If you do know the popular name like jackdaw, you know, or crow, use it. Or say the big wading bird if you can't think, you know, the red shank, if you want to use that as an example. Just so I know what you're talking about. Okay, the only other reading was that little paper that I wrote on the hamster. Okay, so that's your, the major source is the readings. The lectures were mostly on the questions concerning the readings. In addition, I gave an introductory lecture on different approaches to animal behavior. Just take a look at that. You know the major approaches to animal behavior. I also had a section on evolution of behavior from protozoa to primates, and it wasn't very long, but it was something that had not been done in the same way in the textbook. And also we had the chance to augment the text and sometimes correct the text, and often that was just in response to your questions. Okay, and the final source is the videos. We saw three videos, Connor Lawrence and his geese. Rather than give you, I actually have a very nice reading where Lawrence describes the imprinting in a humorous way when he discovered imprinting in some of the ways people in Altenburg, the villagers, looked at him as being this crazy guy that walked around on his haunches in tall grass. Because sometimes they would see him doing that and they couldn't see the ducks that he was trying to lead. But anyway, they would also see him talking to them, and sometimes they couldn't see who he was talking to. He could imitate his geese very well as other. He could imitate jackdaws. He could imitate quite a few animals. Another film, that was actually the second video. The first one was on the three-spined stickleback, remember? And they went through the four questions of Tinbergen for studying behavior, and they gave examples of that from the study of sticklebacks, which is still a popular animal in behavior research. And the third film was on the meerkats of the Kalahari Desert. And for that, we had a discussion session and you wrote out homework. Okay. I think on the Tinbergen film we had some study questions too. I can't remember if I had any on Lawrence. Okay. What are the two multi-purpose actions that are used by a great many fixed action patterns? Two basic movement patterns that are used again and again in fixed action patterns. Not all of them, but in many.
Locomotion and...
locomotion towards, locomotion away. It's a different kind of locomotion. In many cases, locomotion away is backing up. Okay, sometimes includes crouching, many variations of it. But they're two different kinds of locomotion, and these are very basic action patterns that are incorporated again and again in fixed action patterns. And you find that the two types of movements all the way from protozoa to primate. If I just glance at the contents of that Lawrence book, that central section we read, a few things pop out at me. One is, in the early history, Heinroth and Whitman, he always attributes the discovery of fixed action patterns though they didn't call them fixed action patterns. They used equivalent terms. It's been difficult to know what to call them. But what is it about them that Lawrence always calls attention to? That they're inherited. They're genetically determined. It doesn't mean that there's no learning involved at all. And he makes that very clear, especially on the stimulus side. Do you remember the three components of a fixed action pattern that he talks about? The first is appetitive behavior. The second is the innate releasing mechanism involving releasers and the key stimuli they produce that triggers the behavior, and then the execution of a behavior pattern, a specific behavior pattern itself. And it's those last two components that are the least variable. The last one is the least variable, the actual action pattern. The second one, the key stimulus, in many cases is quite fixed, it's genetically determined, but in many cases it's shaped by learning. Like the following response of the ducklings or the geese, when they get imprinted, they have to learn the key stimuli. And the foraging behavior, I mean, the appetitive behavior, which might involve foraging, but it's a kind of seeking behavior, and that's the most variable. It always involves locomotion in search of a stimulus, in search of the stimulus that will elicit the reaction pattern. So why isn't the ASP, the action-specific potential, one of the components we're talking about? That's one of the things that stands out when you scan through that Lawrence reading. He talks a lot about it. He talks about action-specific fatigue. He talks about action-specific potential. Why isn't it that one of the components that we just talked about? Because it's not observable. It's something that happens inside the animal. In fact, it's theoretical from the ethologist's point of view. It might be measurable by a physiologist. Okay. That's the internal motivation and the level of motivation that's changeable, that changes all the time, that builds up over time. It builds up and builds up until finally what can happen. Sorry? Yeah, well, you're using the model, you're right. It builds up, and as it builds up, the threshold for eliciting the behavior is going down. Okay? So the key stimuli do not have to be as strong. A lesser stimulus can elicit the behavior. To such a degree that for many fixed action patterns, they seem to just go up spontaneously. But that's the in vacuo reaction. When they say the reaction happens in a vacuum or in vacuo, it means it appears that there's no stimulus. But in fact, it doesn't. There's always some stimulus, of course. But if the threshold is so lowered, then almost any stimulus is acceptable. We won't use the sex example this time. We'll use the feeding your children example. Your kid hates broccoli, but if he's hungry enough, Now, most people don't like to starve their kids, but if they do, if you like to experiment with your kids, try this. Starve them, and pretty soon they'll be eating those things that they say they hate because their threshold changes, okay? And you can elicit feeding behavior now with much less of a stimulus or even stimuli that are normally not preferred. You remember the meerkats that were very, very hungry would attack the centipede. The centipede tastes terrible, or the millipede, they called it. Tastes terrible, but they would, so they won't normally eat it. Normally they avoid it. It won't elicit their attack behavior and everything. But if they're hungry enough, then it will. A releaser. How is that different from the key stimuli? Aren't the key stimuli the releasers? The releaser is something that evolves to produce key stimuli to elicit a fixed action pattern. Okay. So the male peacock evolves elaborate tail feathers because they're a releaser of behavior in the female. They can attract the female. And releasers then are what we're likely to enhance artificially in order to produce the behavior. And animals enhance them by evolving long tail feathers. The fish, remember the swordtail fish, evolves the long tail, makes him appear to the female to be larger, so she'll be more attracted. So if he's grows up in a deprived environment and can't eat as much, what happens? Well, he doesn't get as big, but he still grows a long tail. And if he didn't have that long tail to grow, he would just be less attractive to the females. So in a way, it's a way of fooling them. Now, Lawrence talks about taxis. And that gets a little confusing, but he's talking about orienting movements during locomotion. That's what a taxis is. It's the orienting that occurs when animals are moving. And it's interesting because in that section on taxis, he has a section called taxis and insight. He's really talking about orienting in space, spatial orientation, and insight behavior. Because he thinks that insight behavior is a major example of higher cognitive abilities, occurs because of animals' ability and animals having a spatial model of the environment. And he discusses the what looks like insight behavior in the fish, a stupid fish that can find its way around a detour, sometimes faster than a dog who's supposed to be much smarter than that fish. But it just has to do with the fixed action patterns of the fish versus the dog. Another section there was multiple simultaneous motivations. It was about the consequence. He said motivations are almost never pure. You're almost always motivated by more than one thing. So the question is, how do you deal with that? How do animals deal with that? And it's been studied mainly when two different motivations are very, very strong. How do animals deal with it? And he goes through these three major different ways of dealing with it. Superimposing the action patterns, alternate where they inhibit each other, then there will be an alternation or a complete suppression of one of them, but often it's an alternation. And another is the displacement activity. They'll execute a third behavior.